Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in the American West, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. I am Stephen Hausman. I'm an assistant professor in the history department at the University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, Minnesota, and I am your host for this interview. And today, I'm speaking with Eric Porter. Dr. Porter is a professor of history at the University of California at Santa Cruz and is the author of A People's History of SFO, The Making of the Bay Area and an Airport, which came out with the University of California Press just a couple months ago, earlier this year in 2023. Welcome to the New Books Network, Eric. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Steve. It's good to be here.
First, why don't we just start, as we always do on the New Books Network, by just hearing a little bit about yourself as an author. What is your background? And in particular, I'm interested in hearing how you became interested in history.
Okay, well, I'm from the Bay Area originally. I guess I would describe myself as a late convert to history. I didn't really grow up as a history buff, but became interested in history and also interdisciplinary studies, interdisciplinary histories in college. Was drawn to a variety of different kinds of courses, began to think more historically about the world at that point in time, and eventually that led to my entry in a PhD program in American Studies, where I studied American Studies, but had a disciplinary foundation in history, and have since done a lot of different kinds of historical work, primarily trained as an intellectual and cultural historian, and have done a lot of work in music studies and traditional intellectual history. I have a book on W.E.B. Du Bois, and have since moved into urban studies, urban history.
And I'm curious what brought you to this topic in particular. You and I were chatting a little bit before we started recording about how I had never encountered a book that used an airport as a way of getting at a larger urban history. So what drew you to the topic of SFO, San Francisco's airport, as a way of understanding this history of the Bay Area? I guess what I'm asking is why an airport and why this airport specifically?
Yeah, Steve, well, it's a complicated story. I mean, on some level, this is a return to some work I thought I might do when I was in graduate school. I had thought at that point in time that I might actually, before I ended up getting into cultural and intellectual history, I thought I might do some kind of Bay Area urban history project. This is a moment in the early 1990s when Mike Davis's City of Quartz was influencing a lot of people, as were a lot of other urban studies across disciplines. So, I had thought at some point I might do something on the Bay Area that sort of followed the lead of some of those other studies, but then again went in a different direction. About a decade or so ago, after doing a book with a friend and colleague, Lewis Watts, who's a photographer, about New Orleans and the cultural reconstruction of that city post-Katrina, that sort of study of a place that I had only recently familiarized myself made me want to return to do something on the place where I was from. And it was, one of those one thing led to another situation. Eventually it dawned on me that writing about an airport as a place where lots of different kinds of people and networks come together. You know, it might be an interesting way to think about how networks and relationships of various kinds help define, constitute an urban area. Airports are also places where they're kind of repositories of accumulated power in a region, in terms of the money behind them, the political figures, business elites whose, you know, sort of interest in developing them is reflected in these infrastructures. So it'd be, you know, I thought it might be an interesting place to look at asymmetrical relationships and networks, and again, the way that power is expressed, accumulated in a region. You know, I also, after writing about a lot of things that I was either deeply critical of or wanted to honor on some level, I thought it might be an interesting challenge to write about something which I'm ambivalent about. I mean, I'm sort of ambivalent about flying. I'm ambivalent about spending time in airports, and I thought that might be an interesting exercise. And, you know, again, this in terms of the part of your question about why this airport in particular, again, it's part of the project of trying to make sense of this region where I'm from. I also have some family history that intersects with this airport. My grandfather was a skycap at SFO, or a porter. He began working there in 1942, a skycap for people who don't know the term, because there aren't many skycaps left at airports, is, you know, it's an occupation. These are people who typically greet passengers at the curb and, you know, carry their baggage inside the airport. And, you know, prior to 9/11, sometimes would check people into their flights at the curb. You know, it was historically an African-American occupation. And, you know, my grandfather was, you know, got a job. At that point in time, his family was living in Shreveport, Louisiana. So he secured this job through word of mouth, you know, at San Francisco's airport in 1942, started working there. And then my grandmother and my father and my aunt joined him a year later. So that was sort of, that event sort of inaugurated my family's participation in the second great migration of African Americans from the South to the, in this case, the Bay Area.
You know, I got to ask, because you said that you're ambivalent about flying and about airports in general. Did writing this book and the process of doing kind of a deep dive and research on airports and this airport in particular, did it change the experience that you have when you visit airports now? Like when you go to SFO, do you view it in a totally different way when you're sitting there waiting to check in for your flight? Are you kind of looking at the world around you at the airport in any kind of new way now?
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, I guess I have to say I haven't been there that many times since working on this book, or at least not in recent years, in part because of, you know, COVID and, you know, sort of the lack of travel in recent years. But, you know, I mean, there's some interesting things about SFO in particular, namely its public art and museum project. And the museum project is a, you know, since the, you know, circa 1980, they've had this program where they have a these different installations scattered across the airport, and, you know, more and more over the years, which, you know, are, I mean, these are exhibits of all kinds of different things, you know, pottery from certain times and places, glass exhibitions, you know, information about certain local phenomena, exhibits culled from different museums in the region. And it's really quite impressive. And actually, SFO has won all of these different, won some awards, at least, for its, again, public art and museum program. So when I happen to spend time there, I have, you know, appreciate those exhibitions more. And, you know, it's just interesting, you know, now that I know a little bit more about how airports function and the kind of work that people do there, to see those dynamics in practice. So I'd say Yes, more of an appreciation, although, again, I haven't spent, really that much more time there in recent years. Although I did do research there. I mean, associated with the museum is an archive, so I was actually able to, you know, go to the international terminal on quite a number of days and sort of go backstage and work in the airport's archives.
So I don't usually ask questions about historiography of my guests, but as I said a second ago, just for me, this was such a new and interesting topic. I couldn't help but be curious. I got to ask, how much have historians and other scholars written about airports before? What kind of literature were you drawing from for this book, or was this sort of a new intervention in some ways?
I mean, I think this is a particular intervention in terms of the types of stories I tell here about a region through the lens of the airport. But there is actually quite a bit of writing about airports and flight. There are a number of, you know, sort of outside of academia, there are quite a few local and regional historians who've written about different airports, you know, across the nation and the world. For example, the former assistant director of SFO Museum, John Hill, has a book on SFO, you know, text and photographs that sort of came out on the occasion of the opening of the SFO's new international terminal circa 2000. There's also a historiography by academic urban historians that often links airports to histories of urban transportation and city and regional development. And, you know, some of this work surveys airports across the nation and, you know, seeks to sort of think about things that, it talks about things in broad strokes, just about the phenomena of airports, phenomenon of airports in general. There are also, a handful of studies that I know about that focus on individual airports. For example, there's an urban historian named Nicholas Bloom, who has a really interesting book on JFK called Metropolitan Airport that sort of links the development the renaming of JFK and its development to, a number of questions around New York City's urban development and sort of urban politics. But beyond that work by historians, there's, quite an interesting range of literature from historians across disciplines who've been, talking about airports vis-a-vis immigration policy or security issues, jet noise. There's a really interesting book by Marina Peterson, who's an anthropologist, called Atmospheric Noise, on anti-jet noise protests and the phenomenon of jet noise around Los Angeles International Airport, LAX. So there's, again, lots of different kinds of scholarship, some of which is written by historians.
I myself, I've never flown into SFO, or I might have flown in once when I was like a child. I was trying to remember. I think I maybe went once when I was a little kid, but for all intents and purposes, I have not been there myself. And you start the book with a description of flying in to SFO. Can you describe what it's like to approach the city and the airport from the air and kind of the experience of visiting the airport today? Maybe we should start in the present before jumping back to the history of this facility.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's interesting to think about flying into the airport because you're right. I do start the book with this description of flying into SFO at night and seeing, these different configurations of light, outlining, helping one identify different cities and different parts of the infrastructure, the lights that define, airports, for example, other, SFO and other airports in the region, or bridges, or, so you show where the refineries are in proximity to the urban areas. So, one can be presented with an interesting mapping of a region, of the Bay Area in particular. And it's certainly one experience at night is a different experience during the daytime where, you see this actually, very interesting, beautiful area. You fly over hills, you fly over water, the bay, depending on which, what direction you're coming in and what your approach is, you may end up over the bay, we almost always end up over the bay at some point. You may end up over the Pacific Ocean at some point in time with some pretty spectacular views, at least if you're sitting by a window. If you're not, then the views are less spectacular. And it can be, it's sort of like once disorienting as you're trying to figure out what precisely you're looking at and how you're situated in the air vis-a-vis the region below. But then sometimes it can also help you understand how certain parts of the region fit together. And then, in terms of the airport itself, in some ways it's like other airports, and certainly lots of commentators have talked about the fact there's a kind of homogeneity of airport experiences because we tend to, undertake the same rituals no matter where we are. And, the aesthetics of airports can be very similar. But, one of the things I try to argue in different moments in the book is that they're similar but with a difference. And, there's a way that the SFO's airport signals to you that it's, that you're, you're, if you're arriving there at least, entering an area, that's sort of known for its multiculturalism, it's known for its, histories of political activism and so forth. And, that gets apparently represented in public art and design features and some of these cultural exhibitions installed by the SFO Museum.
So why don't we start getting into the history of this place? And indeed, why don't we start with the place itself? Can you tell us a bit about the land on which SFO sit? What existed before there was an airport here? Why this site in particular for an airport?
Yeah, so where San Francisco International Airport sits now, I mean, some of where it sits used to be not, well, in the early in the 20th century at least, used to be open water. But the part of the airport that was originally built in the late 1920s was built on reclaimed salt marsh that was reclaimed by a wealthy California banker named Darius Ogden Mills, who was one of the principals of the Bank of California. And made a fortune in part from financing gold mining in the Sierras, silver mining in the Comstock, and also financed and profited from a variety of other extractive ventures and other kinds of business ventures that helped accumulate wealth in the San Francisco Bay Area and made at least a handful of people like himself tremendously rich. So it was his family, his descendants, that first rented and then sold that land, which I guess Mills had originally reclaimed to graze his dairy cows. He was a kind of gentleman farmer as well as a wealthy banker. He had originally reclaimed the land to graze his dairy cows, and it still may have been used for dairying when it was given to the first rented and then sold to the city of San Francisco in the late 1920s. So what I do in the book is try to tell the story of that land as a way of thinking about the complicated asymmetrical relationships that had helped to make this region. Since that's part of the story I try to tell through the region during its existence, I start in the first chapter by talking about some of the antecedents of those relationships, going back to the colonial period, essentially. So what I do is talk about how this this salt marsh was sort of adjacent to lands that were originally under control, sort of back and forth between the, during the Spanish period, between the mission in San Francisco and the San Francisco Presidio, the military outpost. And both of those entities used the surrounding lands to graze cattle. And then it, during the Mexican period, it was, these lands surrounding the airport were part of a California rancho. I tell that story as well. And then, as happened elsewhere, the Californios lost most of their land to, Anglo business interests and speculators and the like during the U.S. period. And, that's how that chunk of land fell into the hands of the Mills family. And I, talk about some of the relationships that happened on or near this land, and actually, I should just go back and say that, I talk about how this land originally was stewarded by and used by Ramaytush Ohlone people who lived in the area prior to the arrival of the Spaniards. And, the adjacent lands were, cultivated and stewarded by the Ohlone people, and these marshlands, were used for ceremony and used, people hunted, fished, gathered, foraged in salt marshes as well. So, part of the story, of course, in this colonial context is violence, and part of the story involves other kinds of asymmetrical relationships that occur in this land. And I talk about how, this land was transformed over the years by, lots of different people, including, well, the land and then the waters as well, just offshore in the bay. So transformed by people like the oyster companies who were using, this underwater land for cultivating oysters, and by Chinese fishermen who were fishing for shrimp in the waters just off, this marshland, and in waters that subsequently were filled in and built on, as the airport itself expanded.
So this might be kind of a strange question given the world that we live in today, where airports are very much an assumed part of urban infrastructure for any city of any sizable city at all. But thinking back to the early days of air travel, let alone commercial air travel in the 1920s, why build an airport at all? What does an airport represent for city elites, city sort of the people that the city leaders, right? What does it represent for these people, for the city itself, in this kind of very early period of air travel?
Well, I think early on, and we're talking about the 20s and early 30s, the airports represented progress. They represented innovation. They represented an ability to, kind of triumph over nature and manipulate the land and the laws of physics, or defy the laws of physics, and, in that sense, symbolize human ingenuity and a capacity for expansion and progress. In the Bay Area, in San Francisco in particular, among city elites and business elites, there was early on a recognition that air travel as it developed might open up doors for a kind of soft imperialism, and in the Pacific world, and facilitate increasing trade and influence in Asia and elsewhere around the Pacific Rim. It was sort of unclear exactly how that might happen, because early on planes planes were small and couldn't go very far, and a lot of the focus was on just airmail transportation. But eventually people became more invested in the idea that airplanes could transport people and goods to and from overseas destinations, and again sort of lead to a and support in this case a region's imperial destiny, and the development of wealth in the region. Another part of the story is that there's, early on in the airport's history, there's a lot of competition between San Francisco, the Bay Area, Los Angeles, Seattle, in terms of which of these urban areas is going to be most influential and best reap the rewards of economic expansion in the West and, into the Pacific Rim. So, there's a fair amount of competition between these regions and a fair amount of anxiety among leaders in these regions as to who will win this struggle. And people see, and some of this is focused on shipping, and those folks who are supporting the early development of aviation see that sphere as a way to, have an increasing influence in terms of trade and, again, Pacific Rim trade, in relation to these other cities.
And almost immediately, SFO. Begins to have an impact. So when is the airport officially opened, and how does the airport immediately begin to change the city and the region in the years after its construction?
Yeah, so the airport first opens officially in 1927 as Mills Field, named after the family who bequeathed the land to the city. It takes a while for it to really have a profound impact because, there's uncertainty. Some faith that aviation will, take off, so to speak, no pun intended. But it takes a while for that to do so. And SFO has, kind of a checkered early history. The facility isn't great. There's a problem with the airfield, which in those days initially was dirt, with during the rainy season, the airport being the airfield being very muddy, the weather isn't great. There's competition with what becomes Oakland Airport across the bay. There's actually early on, as the San Francisco's airport ends up losing some of its business to Oakland because airlines and their pilots see it as a better facility, easier to fly in and out of, et cetera. So it takes a while, but eventually, a couple of things happen. The technology changes, airplanes become bigger, faster, have longer range. Passenger travel becomes more viable as a part of the business. The airlines aren't as dependent on airmail transportation in order to succeed financially. And then there are a lot of resources put into the development, construction, and expansion of airports during the 1930s and into the 1940s in the context of the New Deal. The WPA, the PWA, Public Works Administration, put a lot of money into airports, both as a way of improving the economy during the Depression, putting people to work. But there's also a sense within the federal government that airports construction should be subsidized more generally for the for the longer term good of the economy, and in part because it sort of helps with civilian defense, because there's a sense that the military will be able to use these facilities as well. So I think once that starts to happen across the 1930s, and especially when the economy starts to recover more significantly at the end of the decade, and then of course in the 1940s, the airport becomes a more tangible engine of economic growth in the region, again, as air transportation, both passenger transportation and air cargo increase and become, again, more profitable businesses.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And after World War II, air travel begins to grow increasingly accessible to non-elites. Air travel becomes more common and more accessible. How does this change SFO? Can you explain the, for instance, expansion of the airport in this era and what it tells us about the changing nature of air travel itself and of the Bay Area as well?
Yeah, so the airport expands pretty dramatically first during World War II, like other facilities, and that's in part because both the Army and the Navy are putting a lot of money into expanding the airport, and they're using the facility for military purposes, even as it's still being used as a civilian facility. And that continues in the post-war period. There is, the U.S. government is putting federal money behind airport expansion, which it sees as, sees the development of air travel, air cargo nationally and internationally as important to the development of the, national economy and also the expansion of economic interests abroad as well. That coincides with and helps to promote more access to air travel among, working class and middle class people. And as the economy expands and wages increase, people have, a growing array of people have access to air travel and can afford it. And, airlines, which were primarily catering to a very elite group of people, start to basically, I think this is when you see the development of something that we know or used to know of, at least, as coach, right? And you have these different classes of air travel where you still have this this more comfortable experience catering to elites, but then you have another experience catering to non-elite people. And this is promoted locally by the city of San Francisco. It passes a series of bond measures that support different waves of expansion at the airport. It's seen based on the idea that this is beneficial to the local economy, beneficial to working people, that you see that developing as well. Although of course this develops in ways that are unequal, because again, not everyone has access to these airport jobs that are, one of the things that are promoted as beneficial to the community as, that go along with airport the expansion of the airport. One of the things that this city uses to justify the, its appeal to voters to pass these bond measures. The airport is, the airlines and other entities doing business at the airport, they engage in, systematically discriminatory employment practices, through the 1950s.
Well, those kinds of practices are what I wanted to get into next, because in the 1960s and 1970s, SFO becomes a contested space, a site of protest, becomes a space that represents, to some people, inequality and political neglect and power imbalances. So can you explain some of these controversies surrounding the airport in this era, and maybe what some of the outcomes of these protest movements are?
Sure. So the... I mean, as the airport grows, it has a bigger impact on the region, both as this big, noisy infrastructure that is sort of heard and felt in its surroundings, but also creates other transformations, in proximity, like, increases in traffic congestion, based on, travelers going to and from the airport, as well as workers going to and from the airport. And it's a public infrastructure, and, there are, different expectations by different constituencies in the region about what this big infrastructure might offer them or not, and what the costs and benefits of having this ever expanding infrastructure in the area. So one of the big questions again is what are the costs and benefits of this publicly subsidized infrastructure and the associated economic and other kinds of growth, and how who precisely are the winners and losers when it comes to, what the airport has to offer. So, one of the things I do in the middle of the book, I have, some chapters that, are all focused around different kinds of protests that happen in or in relation to the airport. One of them is, going back to what I was talking about earlier, is one of the chapters looks at Black anti-discrimination struggles at the airport from the late 1950s into the 1980s. And, like other airports, a lot of other airports across the country, SFO just didn't hired very few Black workers prior to the civil rights movement, ramping up in the San Francisco Bay Area. Most Black workers who were hired were doing basically service work. And, a lot of it was low paid service work, like janitorial work or, having lower wage jobs in food service. Although skycaps were, that was a service occupation that actually paid pretty well. But, what I trace, for a while, in part because of discriminatory practices at the airport, and also because activists tended to be focusing their efforts elsewhere, there seemed to be more opportunities. Local activists weren't really paying much attention to the airport. But eventually, as airport employment expanded, and also in the wake of some visible anti-discrimination struggles focused on airlines and on airports elsewhere in the United States, particularly, probably most notably focusing on flight attendants' efforts to get access to, or Black women's efforts to get access to flight attendant jobs, primarily in the Midwest and the East Coast. Local activists started to ramp up their efforts to get Black people jobs at SFO. And so what I trace are a number of different struggles by civil rights organizations, church organizations to get access to jobs. There are also efforts by the city of San Francisco and its Human Rights Council to institute affirmative action programs at the airport to try to open up airport work, in part because of this pressure from civil rights organizations. I talk also about efforts to improve the kinds of jobs that Black workers could get at the airports, you know, in the face of union discrimination and its discrimination by the airlines. And, you know, that involves organizing at different levels. It involves, you know, some, excuse me, Black workers, you know, working within their unions. It involves other Black workers, and sometimes some of the same Black workers, organizing outside of their unions through Black employee organizations that cut across occupation to try to work sort of differently with the airlines to improve their status as workers and again gain access to other kinds of jobs. And that and sometimes involves putting direct pressure on airlines to institute affirmative action programs. There are also efforts by Black contractors and other business people to get access to establish concessions at the airport and get access to contracts, construction contracts for airport construction contracts for airport expansion. So it's a really complicated story, and one of the things I try to you know, suss out and describe here, you know, going back to what I said earlier about airports being really fascinating places where lots of different people and networks come together, is just how complicated the terrain of activism is and how many different kinds of groups and people are involved to try to, you know, make employment conditions or business conditions better for Black people. And, you know, in terms of, you know, the question about outcomes, the outcome is that there were some successes, but there were also pretty significant limits. And the Black workers were able to, you know, make significant gains in certain occupations, but not so much in the professional ranks. And in terms of the business side of things, you know, there was a moment when, you know, the representation of Black business people in airport contracts and concessions looks more or less like what you might expect in the broader Bay Area population. But, you know, once some of the affirmative action programs were cut back in the wake of the Bakke decision and the like, you know, some of those gains were lost. And, you know, one of the things I talk about in the chapter is that, you know, what Black workers and business people were able to achieve was a kind of patchy inclusion in terms of participation in this infrastructure that, you know, never quite succeeded. And, you know, to some degree in later years, you know, that foothold actually diminished, which, you know, had some parallels in terms of the broader story of the Black presence in the San Francisco Bay Area. Another chapter, you know, from this part of the book that I that involves protest has to do with anti-jet noise protests in the area, and I talk about the ways that there's a really interesting story of how, you know, suburban quality of life politics, which, you know, sort of was define kind of early anti-jet noise protests in the late 1950s and early 1960s began to coincide more and more with a burgeoning environmentalism in the region. And it was, you know, so again, there's a long history of anti-jet noise politics. The result of which is that there were some successes in terms of putting pressure on the airport to make some changes in flight operations and to assist communities in terms of developing programs that included things like providing grants for people to insulate their homes to make them a little more soundproof. And that, along with changes in technology, led to some decrease in noise around the airport. But it's a complicated story. People are still complaining about jet noise, decades and decades later. And, it's often different communities get drawn into this economy of noise and protest after there are changes to flight operations for different kinds of reasons and approaches to the airport, the flight paths are changed or altered somewhat, and that can make things noisier, less noisy for one group that had been experiencing noise and noisier for another group. So I think that's another interesting part of this story.
Yeah, yeah. And this story of SFO being this kind of hub of activism and a symbol for, power dynamics and inequality, this doesn't end with the 20th century either. This is an ongoing story well into the 21st century, too. And in the book, you talk about the airport becoming a hub of immigration-related activism in the early 21st century. Can you talk a little bit about that? And kind of similar to the last question, I'm curious, what were the outcomes and maybe also the limits of that particular version of activism at the airport?
Yeah, so there are a couple things notable in the 21st century. I mean, I talked about some immigration-related protests that happened earlier as well, but certainly a couple of notable protests that happen sort of at the airport and then have resonance, in activist communities, across the Bay Area. I mean, one are the protests on behalf of, by and on behalf of non-citizen security workers at the airport, many of whom were Filipino. After 9/11, the Aviation Transportation Security Act that was passed, which, among other things, establishes the Transportation Security Administration, the TSA, that imposes a citizenship requirement on airport security workers, which jeopardizes the jobs of a lot of, in particular, Filipino workers, who are on, who had green cards or were on work visas who did security work at the airport. So, a lot of activism on their behalf to try to get them, let them keep their jobs. There was a, they were able to kind of delay the impact of the Security Act, so that it didn't take place at SFO until a little later than it did at some other airports. But eventually, the non-citizen workers lost their jobs. Another thing I talk about briefly, and this is something that was in the news just several years ago, is after President Trump's so-called Muslim ban, there were significant protests at SFO, as there were at other airports across the nation. Protesting the attempt to prevent people from different countries from entering the United States, primarily Muslim countries, from traveling to entering or immigrating into the United States. So one of the things I talk about in this chapter is that in these struggles, sometimes to present, protect the rights of people to, in one case, hold jobs, in the other case, to enter, return to the country, there's often this rhetoric of deservingness that gets mobilized to support their cause. For example, when it comes to the non-citizen workers, there's this sort of rhetoric around their patriotism, their commitment to the nation. When it comes to the Trump's Muslim ban, often, what you heard some activists at least say, not all, but some activists say, is, they really focused on the deservingness of certain people who would be affected by the ban. Like, you know, well, look, these folks are students at Stanford and Berkeley, or these folks are, you know, they're working in the tech industry and are contributing to the local economy that way. And sometimes when that rhetoric was mobilized, it, you know, it focused on the deservingness of some people and kind of assume the undeservingness of other people as well. You know, for example, like some of this rhetoric supporting the patriotism of Filipino security workers sort of assumed as okay the targeting of Muslim travelers as potential terrorists, you know, vis-a-vis that security apparatus, or that rhetoric which, you know, tended to champion the causes of, you know, students at elite institutions, elite universities, or workers in the tech economy, you know, didn't really have much to say at all about lower wage workers, say. So I, you know, I talk a little bit about the limit, the sort of rhetorical limits of and the political limits of those mobilizations. Although that didn't, of course, define all the people who were involved in these struggles, because other people were, you know, for example, there were activists who were, you know, finding common cause between Filipino workers who were seen as, you know, not sufficiently American, you know, as people from outside the U.S., as a racialized population, finding common cause and similarities between their experiences and Muslim Americans who were, you know, again, targeted by the security apparatus.
So as we begin to wrap up here, I'm wondering if we can maybe look to the present and maybe the future a little bit. And I'm wondering what you think SFO, what this airport, this institution, what do you think it tells us about the contemporary Bay Area? And then looking forward a bit, what is the future of this airport? I mean, I don't think anyone will predict that the airport is going to shut down anytime soon or anything so dramatic. But how do you see it changing? And with those changes, how is the Bay Area going to change?
So in terms of, you know, how it reflects the Bay Area, I mean, I think it's interesting. And I think the story is contradictory. I mean, on one level, I mean, again, going back to the art and design elements and the cultural exhibitions, I mean, there's a way that this airport, in, you know, aesthetically, in terms of who works there, reflects the multiculturalism of the region. I think a lot of the artworks speaks to the progressive politics that define the region. I mean, even some of the politics of the airport, I mean, even some of the operations of the airport itself reflect some of the progressive dynamics in the Bay Area. You know, over the last couple of decades, there's been a kind of living wage program established at the airport, which kind of imposes, you know, by the city, by the airport, that sort of imposes a living wage requirement on airlines and other entities that do business there. That's sort of tied to living wage efforts in the Bay Area and San Francisco more generally. The airport has, you know, as far as airports go, has engaged in a pretty impressive array of sustainability programs that, you know, I think also reflect the, you know, the Bay, you know, the sort of impact of environmentalists in the Bay Area and their ability to shape the operations of a number of kinds of civic institutions, infrastructures, and businesses. All that said, I mean, the airport still reflects the profound and growing inequalities that define the region. I mean, you can see that, you know, these sort of racialized class dynamics are apparent at SFO, like most airports, in terms of who does what kind of work there, and what kinds of occupations people have, either whether working for the airlines or working for some of the concessions, and also reflected, I guess, maybe in an indirect way in terms of just the hierarchies that define air travel, in terms of who gets access first to airplanes, who sits where on airplanes, who has access to certain kinds of lounges and the like. And, again, this is, this region, like others, is, undergoing, we witness, I mean, not like these asymmetries didn't occur before, but this is this kind of, contemporary exacerbation of, differences and, sort of resegregation of the area. So I can see that the airport is a kind of macrocosm of that. In terms of the future of the airport, I mean, again, like you said, it's a little hard to predict. I think one of the, getting back to these sustainability and programs, I mean, and some of the other things, the sustainability programs which are related to some of the things, I mean, one aspect of that are the things that the airport is trying to do to the extent it can, ameliorate climate change. And, it's doing some interesting things in terms of energy conservation and trying to put support behind this project to develop alternative kinds of jet fuel. Tied to that is a reality that sea level rise could have a pretty profound effect going forward on airport operations. This is an airport built right next to the bay, and so it is, the runways aren't very high above the bay water at high tide at the present. And in addition to that, the airport is sinking, in part because it was built on landfill, and just the enormous weight of the runways and the concrete and steel infrastructure is causing, as scientists have recently discovered, the airport to sink at a fairly alarming rate. So one of the things the airport is doing is trying to, it's in the process right now of developing plans to build a seawall that would potentially at least protect the airport from some of the sea level rise that could happen if projections are correct by about 2100. Whether that will be successful or not is it's dependent on what level of sea level rise actually happens, and whether these site-specific remediation projects, protection projects, can actually be successful when when sea level rise is a systematic kind of phenomenon. So, yeah, we'll see. I guess one of the things, back to your question, it may not have much of a future if these aren't successful. But it's, it'll be interesting to see how that story plays out in terms of, this bigger story of how climate change will affect a region, again, built, around these bodies of water. And, to what extent will trying to ameliorate that, what communities will that take into, who will be protected? What communities' interests will be taken into account? To what extent will that project be, will it be democratic? Will it, protect interests of low-income people as well as, elite interests? And, as one can imagine, it's, there's certainly lots of factors lining up that would seem to indicate that it will be the interests of the powerful, the interests of those institutions, infrastructures that serve power, serve elite interests, that will be protected first. But again, that story is still unfolding.
And then finally, at the end of my conversations, I always like to ask my guests to imagine themselves, well, imagine their book through the eyes of one of their readers, of someone reading this book and then remembering the book maybe a year down the line, maybe a couple years down the line. What do you hope that this reader would remember or would take away from this book, thinking back on it from a few years later on?
Well, I'd hope they would take away that there are lots of interesting stories that, you know, compose a region and its development over time, and that they'd be drawn to some of the ones that are in this book, you know, again, regarding the anti-discrimination struggles that happen at the airport or, you know, the anti-jet noise struggles. I hope people would think that telling the story of a particular piece of land can be interesting, but I think, you know, maybe a bigger takeaway that I hope people would get from this is that airports are really fascinating, strange places that they're not all the same. They actually do in really interesting ways serve as touchstones for a region, and they, in a sense, are archives for a regional for a region's history. I mean, that can be read sort of alongside other kinds of archives to tell, again, you know, interesting stories of encounter and network power and the like in a particular region. I mean, this one that I wrote about, but other regions, of course, as well.
I know that I'm flying next week, and I know I'm going to be looking at the two airports that I'm going to be traveling through with very new eyes after reading this book. So thank you very much.
Okay, you're welcome. I hope they are interesting. That ends up being an interesting experience for you.
Well, that's the thing is that, you know, it's two airports I've flown through a lot, and in the past they never have been, but now I think they will. So in that way, I think this book was pretty successful.
Great. I'm glad to hear that.
Dr. Eric Porter is a professor of history at the University of California at Santa Cruz, and his new book is A People's History of SFO, The Making of the Bay Area and an Airport, which came out with the University of California Press earlier this year in 2023. Thank you so much once again for joining me today, Eric.
You're welcome. It was a real pleasure.